Is it possible to know the truth? The second talk in a series titled Christianity and Truth was presented by David Crabtree on October 2, 2001, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
The topic, is it possible to know the truth? I should be able to answer it in one word. I've decided to make my answer more extensive than that. What I'm going to do is first of all talk about the fact that skepticism, that is the negative answer to this question, skepticism does not fit the real world. And I'm going to argue that that's the case. It doesn't describe the real world. There is an alternate perspective, the biblical worldview, which does account for whether we can know the truth, answering that positively, and I will argue that that does describe the real world. So those are the two parts of what I'm going to talk about tonight. It's difficult to avoid skepticism these days. Skepticism is in the air. If you walk down the street to the university campus, you will hear sentiments of skepticism voiced in various ways all the time. But just because it's voiced doesn't mean that it is possible and consistent. There is a section in Alice in Wonderland, which I was going to look up, but I forgot to. But I think it goes like this. If it isn't in Alice in Wonderland, it should be in Alice in Wonderland. Alice was talking to one of the other characters, and she said, it's impossible to believe that. And the person, the character that she is speaking to says, that's impossible. I can't believe that. And the character says, you can believe impossible things. It just takes practice. I try to believe two impossible things every day. So with practice, one can become a skeptic. And if there are enough people voicing sentiments of skepticism around us, it's like anything else. It gains plausibility just as you encounter more and more people that believe it. But that doesn't make it so. Skepticism, I would say, is not in keeping with what philosophy should be doing. It is the role of philosophy to try to explain the way things are. And skepticism is not explaining the way things are. Let me use an example. Many years ago, I worked in an institution, a medium security institution for juvenile delinquents in the state of Washington, which meant that I spent most of my time playing ping pong and pool. Was never good at either one of them, but I played a lot of ping pong, table tennis. And we played it so much, I was playing it with inmates, and it got to the place where it was a little boring to play table tennis. And occasionally, we would get into this contest where I'd hit the ball to the person on the other side, and before it hit the table, he would hit it back. And before it hit the table on my side, I would hit it back. And so it was just going back and forth without hitting the table at all. And what we discovered is, once you get going like that, you don't have to stay near the table. You can go all over the room, hitting it back and forth. And it was kind of fun. It was a variation on the theme. It broke the boredom. And so every once in a while, a table tennis game would erupt into this thing that would move all over the room. The interesting thing about that is, we still said it was table tennis, but it no longer had anything to do with the table. We had lifted it up off the table and moved it. And not only that, the rules actually change. Because when you're playing table tennis, you're trying to hit it to the other player in a way that they can't return it and hit it on your side of the table. In order to do what we were doing, we had to change the rules. It was a tacit agreement that we were doing a different thing here. Philosophy can do the same thing. Philosophy is supposed to explain the way things are. It's supposed to give us insights. It's supposed to examine and give us insights as to how things really are, how things work. But it is possible for philosophy to go through the same kind of transformation where it's no longer explaining how things are and takes on this other task of saying, what if this were true? If this were true, then how would things look? That may be an interesting thing to do. That may be an interesting way of using your time. But it's no longer explaining how things are. It's changed its task. Even if it goes under the name of philosophy, it's changed its task. So it becomes kind of a mind game rather than an actual philosophy. Okay, how could I say then that skepticism is not a description of the way things are? No one is a thoroughgoing skeptic. No one in this room, I would argue, is a thoroughgoing skeptic. Do any of you truly doubt whether you exist or not? Raise your hand. I don't see any hands, and if you didn't exist, I couldn't see your hand anyway. I mean, really, you cannot doubt your existence. You can only imagine doubting your existence. But you can't really doubt your existence. Oftentimes, people who argue skepticism say, well, dreams can be so lifelike that they confuse us, and we think that the dream is real. Is it not possible that what I'm experiencing now is really a dream? Do any of you really question whether what you are experiencing now is a dream? I have no question, but what this is not a dream. Dreams are qualitatively different. They can, for short periods of time, confuse us, but at least in my dream life, I usually recognize incongruities, things that are weird, even within the dream itself. I don't know what your dreams are like. But even the dreams themselves cast doubt on their reality over as the dream extends, as it goes on. And I usually wake up before I wake up, I usually realize that it's a dream. So, we really cannot doubt whether knowledge is possible. There are some things that we can know, and it is beyond doubt. If it were possible, truly, to doubt whether we can know anything, then the place for a person like that is in an institution because they need help, because there's something wrong with the way they're thinking about stuff. They have a mental deficiency of some sort. Now, I know it's been argued that, no, those are the ones who really see. Those are the geniuses. The ones who doubt everything and are in institutions, those are the geniuses. But please note that if they are geniuses, they can't cope with life. They have to be taken care of. If they were turned out on the street, they wouldn't be able to survive. So if we are really consistent and doubt everything, it would be incompatible with life. You couldn't go on living. So, skepticism, then, it just does not match with reality. There's no way that one can be consistently doubting of any knowledge at all, of all knowledge. So the question, then, the more interesting question is not, can we know, but trying to explain the observation that we all know things. We do all know things, and we all know that we know things. So the really interesting question for philosophy to solve is, why is it that we know things? And that's what the biblical worldview has an answer for. Think about what a remarkable fact that is, that we can know things. We start as infants. We start as a single cell. And we develop into, from that, we develop into a being that can understand a great deal about reality. We can understand the movement of the bodies in the solar system. It is possible, through applying our reason and making observations, to figure out what is happening in the solar system with the body, with the movement of the planets. We can understand a lot about human psychology. We can understand a lot about the flow of history, what has happened in the past and why it has happened in the past. We can understand even things about God and his attributes. That is truly remarkable. Starting from a single cell to develop into an organism that can then look around at the world and make considerable sense of it. That's remarkable. That's amazing. So that's the interesting question for philosophy, is how can that happen? And any sound worldview must be able to account for the fact that we know things. Okay, I would argue then that the biblical worldview does have an adequate way of accounting for the fact that we know things and that we know that we know things. From the biblical perspective, all of creation was created by a creator. And this creation was made as a means of self-expression on the part of the creator. God made the universe as a way of expressing who he is. Much like an artist, a painter, painting a picture. That picture tells you something about the one who created it. Or a novel. A novel tells you something about the author of that work. It's self-expression. Similarly, the universe is the handiwork of God, and it tells us much about the one who made it. Furthermore, God wants to make himself known, and he made creation to be known. He made it knowable. So he made creation knowable, and he made us, and he made us to be knowers. He built into us the tools that we need to be able to know that which is outside, that which is in the world. It is a significant fact that in Genesis, after God made Adam, the first thing that he had him do was he gave him an assignment. And his assignment was to name all of the animals. And so Adam went about the process of, presumably, looking at all of the animals, studying them, and then determining what was the essential characteristic of each species, if he gave a name to every species. The interesting thing about that is God's first assignment for Adam was a scientific exercise, a study of creation. Some element of creation. What was God's purpose? God wanted Adam to come to a better understanding of how he fit into this creation, that is, that he's different from the animals. He also wanted Adam to observe that all of the other animals came in matched sets, except for him. So that was an assignment that God gave Adam in preparation for then God creating Eve, a helpmate for him. That little exercise was an exercise designed for someone who can know creation. and can learn then from creation something about himself, something about the created order, the animals in particular, and also something about God. All of those things were built into that assignment. So right from the beginning, man was created to be a knower and was set out to know the world. So there's a fit. The world is knowable, and we were made to be knowers. It makes sense then that reality is perceptible. We have the means to perceive reality in various ways. We can see, we can hear, we can taste, we can smell, we can feel. Did I get them all? So we have ways of perceiving what's out there, and what's out there was made to be perceptible. Now, Jack talked last week about Thomas Reed's his understanding of how that works. That is, that when I feel this podium, I'm not sure whether to describe it as smooth or whether to describe it as rough. It's someplace in between. But when I feel this podium, I get certain sense signals that are sent to my brain. Now, the sense signals that are sent to my brain, they are not yelling smooth or rough. I'm not sure what they're yelling, but my brain is built in such a way that I am able to translate. It's like a language that the surface is speaking through my fingers to my brain that is saying smooth or rough. It is as if there is a language that my senses understand and are able then to make sense of as I perceive things out in the world. If he's right then, that means that the world out there being perceptible means it gives off certain language, and I have the ability to perceive that language and make sense of it. Much like we have the ability to speak that too. We have the ability to give off signals that can be comprehended, and we have the ability to take in signals from others and convert those into meaningful statements. So that ability to perceive is built into us and is truly remarkable. It allows us to make sense of the world that's out there. Furthermore, we have rational faculties, and creation is rationally ordered. We are constantly looking for coherent explanations for the various things that we observe and the various things that we experience. We are looking for consistency and coherence, and our mind wants to do that. It wants to find the consistency and the coherence in all of the things that we find. And we can't help ourselves. Even the one who argues for skepticism uses reason to try to make that argument. And what they're doing then is they are using reason to try to show that reason can't be trusted, which is a curious project. Furthermore, it has been striking to me that the physical laws are relatively simple. God made the cosmos knowable. Let me use an illustration and then I'll come back to this. It has been observed by historians that seagoing peoples, the first seagoing peoples, develop in one of three places. Either in Southeast Asia, in the Mediterranean, or in the Baltic Sea. Those are the three places where you have really skilled seagoing peoples develop. Why would that be? Why would they develop in those places and not other places? It's because in each of those places, it is relatively sheltered. Each of those places has conditions in which sailing is relatively easy. Someone who wants to start out sailing off the coast of England is going to have a very difficult time, because the Atlantic there is very difficult to sail in. But someone who's sailing in the Mediterranean will have a much easier time. The weather is much more difficult, is much easier, much more consistent, and you are within, you are close to land most any place that you want to go. So, sailing developed in those places because the steps towards becoming a sailor were relatively easy, as opposed to being thrown out into the Atlantic. Similarly, it is curious to me that the physical laws of the universe are relatively, the basic ones are relatively simple and discernible. This first was impressed upon me when we started a business making a product called Janduya. Janduya was a combination of ground hazelnuts and chocolate. And some of you have probably tried Nutella. When I was in Europe, I ate Nutella and thought it was great stuff. And when we started thinking about creating a business, it was my idea to try to improve upon Nutella. Well, Nutella is chocolate and hazelnuts. And we started working on a recipe, and we came up with a recipe that we liked and turned out we could make it turn out well. And we did this by taking small amounts of ground hazelnuts and small amounts of chocolate, melting the chocolate in the microwave, mixing them together, sticking that in the refrigerator, and then letting it set up. You know all this. Letting it set up, and we could get it so it worked out. It turned out fine, and we were pleased with the taste and the texture. So, it was time to go into production. And when we went into production, we had this vat. It was a large vat. It was about this big around, 4 feet in diameter around, and about this tall, about 4.5 feet tall. And we put chocolate in there. We put 100 pounds of chocolate in there and about 100 pounds of nuts, and mixed that stuff together. And when we did it and bottled it, the fat separated, the oil separated to the top, and it was nothing like the samples that we had made. Okay, so I was given the task of figuring out why. Why was it that in small batches we could get it to turn out, but in large batches we couldn't get it to turn out at all? So I sat down and started listing all of the variables that I could think of. And that was a daunting project, because what's a variable that affects it? Does the temperature at which you melt the chocolate make a difference? How high that temperature goes, does that make a difference? Does it make a difference how hot the nuts are when you put those in? Does it make a difference what temperature you cool the mixture at? Does it make a difference how long the mixture stays in the refrigerator before you take it out? Now, we can go on and on, but it gets scary as you expand on. Does it depend on the barometric pressure? Does it depend on the humidity? Does it depend on the day of the week? I mean, reality could have been so complex that we would never have gotten anywhere. It would have been impossible to sort things out. But fortunately, reality, the basic principles of physics and chemistry are relatively simple. It's like we're starting in the Mediterranean. They do get very complex, There are lots of interactions and nuances to it. But it's like we're starting in the Mediterranean, fairly simple, and then we're ready for the Atlantic Ocean. Is that happenstance? I think not. God created the cosmos to be knowable. And as a result, He let us start in the Mediterranean rather than in the Atlantic. It's a secret. The biggest variable at all. So, God wants reality to be known by man. He made the cosmos to be known. It is knowable, even though it is a puzzle. There is much that is very challenging within it. Okay, if God made truth to be known and made man to know the truth, why is there so much disagreement? Why do people disagree so much as to what is true? And in fact, I think it's that observation that there is so much disagreement about fundamental things as to whether they are true or not that has led to the development of skepticism, at least the popularization of skepticism. Well, first of all, we need to recognize that there is much about which there is agreement. If we were to talk about what we agree on as being true, I think you would realize that there is an enormous amount of common ground, things about which there is no disagreement. However, it is true that there are many things about which there is violent disagreement, and many of those things are the most fundamental things. And let me see if I can explain why that's the case. The way I envision it, truth is like a tree, an upside down tree. I call this the tree of knowledge. Okay. And there are, we each, every human being constructs one of these trees. And to show you what I mean by this tree, there are things down here, things that we observe and things we believe to be true about the universe. And from these observations, and we reach conclusions about what would be true at a more general level. Let me chart out one example. I came up with one. If I were to drop a piece of chalk, I won't go through the exercise because I think you all know what would happen. But if I let go of this, presumably it would fall. So that is one of these. This chalk fell. That's something that I believe to be true. Now, if I watch a lot of pieces of chalk fall, here's another piece of chalk that falls, and here's another piece of chalk that falls, another instance where I see that. I reach the generalization that if you let go of chalk, it falls. And if I see other things fall, so let's see, here, let's do this. Pens fall. And if I watch enough different things fall, I reach the generalization, things fall. Don't worry, I won't go through the whole tree. We reach the conclusion, the generalization then from this, that gravity exists. And from other things that we observe and generalizations we make the observation that the universe is orderly. And from that generalization, we reach the conclusion, I'll call it a conclusion, that there is an orderer. And from that, we reach the conclusion that God exists. Now, I'm not actually arguing that that's the way we build up our... we actually come to the conclusion that God exists. I'm just trying to show that that all of these are related, moving up from a singular observation to generalizations building up. to a more general truth that accounts for that which is under it. Now, I realize that this is, that what I've done here is very simplistic, but I think that this captures the way that our knowledge builds upon itself. It is all interrelated, and that our understanding of the cosmos is very complex. The cosmos is very complex. Our understanding has to be very complex. Furthermore, at every juncture, we are making judgments. We are reaching conclusions on the basis of evidence, and we are making, that is a judgment. So there are lots of judgments that go into the creation of this tree of knowledge. And if there are lots of judgments, there are lots of places to go wrong. It would make sense then that not all of us would have the same picture of reality, because a lot goes into making it. Notice also that if we look at things on this lower level, that chalk falls, pens fall, there is not much at stake there. Those are the kinds of things about which it's very easy to agree, because it doesn't much matter to us whether it's true or whether it's not true. An example. Last year I was teaching through a biology book to my children, and I read in there that fish have a particularly keen sense of smell. I thought that was very interesting. I don't know of a shred of evidence that that's true, but I don't doubt it. Why don't I doubt it? There's not much at stake. It doesn't matter to me whether they can smell or not. It won't affect me a bit. There are things down at this lower level that they don't really impact my life. And as a result, I'm easily convinced of it. But if someone were to come along tomorrow and say, they can't smell at all, I'd be easily dissuaded. It wouldn't take much. All I need is one piece of evidence, because I don't have any at this point. So agreeing on things down here is relatively easy. It's when we get up to this realm, when we get up to this higher realm, now it gets sticky. Now we're talking about things that impact the way I live my life every day. Now there's something really at stake. And when there's something really at stake, then it's like the rules change. Then I want evidence. And in a sense, rightfully so. But because there's something at stake up here, and there are certain things that are at issue that have a bearing on the way that I live my life every day, and there are certain ways that I would like to live my life every day, that has an influence on the judgments that I make at these various junctures. That my desire for what's up here is anticipated by the decisions that I make at these junctures that affect the result. It's very difficult for us to build this without prejudicing, prejudging how we're going to turn at these various junctures. And the kinds of issues that come into play here are the really critical ones are, who am I? What should I be doing? And all that's related to, is there a God and what kind of God is He? And what is the relationship between me and God? Those are the kinds of issues that are really critical that affect everything that we do. And I would argue they affect the way that we see all of the rest of this tree. It has a huge impact. There's a lot at stake. That's why things like the issue of evolution is contentious, whereas whether fish smell is not. There's really something at stake in the debate on evolution. that affects the way we live every day. The issue of abortion. The issue of abortion is different from surgery to remove an appendix, because there's something really at stake there that affects us on a day-to-day basis. This phenomenon also accounts for the fact that there are times when we can embrace a perspective that we have no evidence for whatsoever. Why? But because we like it, and or we like the implications of that particular view. So seeing what's at stake, seeing down the road, has a huge impact on what decisions we make in putting together our tree of knowledge. In the Gospels, when it's talking about the truth, Jesus claimed to be the truth. Oftentimes, what it's talking about are these really high-level issues. Who is God? Who am I? And the relationship between us. Because once those are in place, there's a sense in which that gives shape. It may not fill out all the details, but it gives shape to everything below it. And those are the issues that are of paramount importance. It's the issues of the gospel. And those have, what truths are there have enormous implications for how we live our lives. So there is an enormous amount that's at stake. Okay, so the reason there are so many disagreements as to what is true is because, first of all, it really is complex. And we all are working to do our best to put things together. There are a lot of judgments that have to be made, and there are a lot of places where we can go wrong. But in addition to that, putting together an understanding of the truth that fits reality, it requires a great deal of integrity. What we want to be true has a huge impact on how we create that tree. So the main prerequisite then for putting together and knowing the truth is a desire to know it no matter what is true. It's that passionate desire to know what's true wherever the truth leads that is critical for putting together a tree that matches reality. That's all I had planned to say. Questions? Logan.
As you move up the hierarchy, is it that the rules change or that rules are added? For example, in the faith debate, how can you believe in Jesus if you've never seen him? And the guy retorts with, how can you believe your brain if you've never seen that? Okay, now, that's a rule, right? And that rule will make sense at the lower level for a lot of things, right? But once you get up here, does that rule still make sense?
Well, but even at this lower level, that rule doesn't hold for everything, right? I mean, is the rule you can only believe what you can see?
That's a good point.
I mean, if we think about it, there are lots of things that we believe exist that we can't see. So even as I'm describing it, even at the lower level, that rule would not be consistently held to. But what I meant to say is, it's not so much that the rules ought to change, but we start imposing rules up here that we might not impose down here because there's not the same amount at stake. We can make the standard so high that nothing could meet it if we don't want it to be true. Isn't that, do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So it's not that the rules have to change, it's that psychologically we have that tendency to require much greater rigor when it's an issue that has a significant impact on our lives, whereas, and we all do that, and I don't know that it's necessarily wrong, but like with fish smelling, the standards for me accepting that are pretty low. I mean, it said it in a textbook. And I don't feel guilty about that particularly. I mean, because I don't care.
That brings my fishing hook.
Yes?
Okay, so what happens to the tree when, say, your tree started out, you know, God doesn't exist and the earth is 6 billion years old. All of a sudden, you're, oh, God does exist and it changes all the branches below it.
Right, right. Theoretically, that would have to happen. That if someone initially believes there is no God and has developed this tree, that if they then change this up here, what am I going to do with the one that works? If you lop this off and put something else on, that it should have implications for, maybe not, it won't have implications for everything down here, but it will have implications for a lot of the ways that these junctions come together. That's true. That's what should happen. But as human beings, we are capable of constructing a tree that where branches don't meet. Capable of grafting something on here that doesn't quite match up with what was down here and tolerate that for some period of time. I mean, realistically, we all have a tree that doesn't quite work. And it's only over time that the places where things don't come together right, contradictions in our understanding come to our awareness and we work those through. Or we ignore them. I mean, those are the two options. Or explain it away. That we either face into it and make the necessary adjustments or deny that there is a problem. That's what we can do with contradictions. But it is important to note that if this diagram captures reality at all, if your understanding of who God is changes at all, that should have a ripple effect through all of this tree. And there will be places that there are contradictions then that we need to work out, and there are other places where it doesn't change it at all. But it should have a ripple effect that would run down the whole thing, at least in principle. I've certainly had that experience, that as my understanding of who God is has changed, it is over time that I realize, oh, well, if that's true of God, then I have to change this belief about, for instance, how I deal with my children. Or I have to change this way that I think about education. Or I have to change this thing about the way I relate to my neighbor. But oftentimes it takes years for those to rise to the surface and you become cognizant of that contradiction.
I think it's interesting to note that like 90% of everything that people talk about are in those lower tiers.
Right.
And the reason that they're butting heads is because they've made different assumptions about
right.
the main trunk
right.
of that tree.
Right.
I don't understand why don't you get it? You know, it's very simple.
Right. For instance, the let's say someone who is a naturalistic evolutionist. This section is all the same, right? But what they have up here is really good luck. We were really lucky that the universe is so orderly that's just luck happens. But notice there's a lot that's agreed upon here. There's a lot of common ground, but you get above that, and that's a sharp disagreement. And because of that sharp disagreement, there are obviously ramifications of that elsewhere in this tree. But we can talk about chalk falling and stuff all the time, and everybody says, yeah, that's what happens. I've seen it happen too. What?
It's sunny out, man.
Yeah, right, right, right.
But don't you think a lot of people never even think about the top?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, never have considered why why they disagree or why their worldviews, I mean, the parts of their worldview don't
right.
agree.
Right, right. It's easy to talk about this common ground, and it's safe to talk about this common ground. But if you start talking about these more significant things, these higher issues, then it gets tough. And so, yes, I think we avoid that, and there are some people that never want to explore up above the common.
And that includes Christians, too.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of people just assume what they've been taught at the bottom and never bother to decide why.
Yes.
You talked about a person's ability to hold two contradictory ideas at the same time. That sounds like a bad thing, but as I was hearing you talk about it, it actually could be to our advantage, because that ability allows us to provisionally adopt someone else's ideas to test them out, and that would further understanding for us.
Mm-hmm.
So that ability is maybe neutral, but can be used to gain knowledge or to avoid knowledge. Would you say?
Well, yes. I mean, that ability to hear someone out, hear their perspective out, and to construct then what does their tree look like from that, that's a wonderful ability. But to live our lives with contradictions, truly live our lives with contradictions, rather than just playing, just thinking them out, extrapolating from them so that we can see what that tree looks like, we can't live with contradiction. God, part of being a rational being is we cannot believe that X is both true and not true at the same time in the same way. We can't accept that. That just throws our whole mechanism. Our whole mechanism says, no, can't work. But that ability to see another perspective sympathetically, that is, see it and take it seriously, that's a wonderful quality to have.
Why do you think God designed it so that the simple, less important things are so clear to us? And even with the desire to know further up the tree, it gets so difficult and unclear of what the purpose. I mean, we know the truth is ultimately God, but all those mid branches of why and what the pathway is, I mean, why do you think he made it unclear or so much more difficult?
Well, it is difficult, but I think it's not unclear. That I don't think it is the case that we have to fill in all of the branches between here and here to know that God exists. That in fact, if we fill out a few here, we can extrapolate and say, therefore God exists. I don't know exactly how to chart out this stuff in the middle, but I've got enough here to know that God exists.
So do you think we spend too much time trying to chart out the middle stuff?
Well, I think there is a sense in which we can't help it. We are curious beings. We want to know. And we want to fill in the blanks as much as we possibly can. Some people are going to go further in that than other people, but none of us, I don't think any of us can quench our curiosity completely. We want to explore, we want to figure things out. We may all focus on different areas more than other areas, but we all want to figure things out. And God made us that way. But one of the curious things about this is constructing this tree, at least in its essential shape, is not so much a matter of intelligence as it is a matter of integrity. That it's integrity that gives us that shape, that helps us to perceive that shape. Intelligence may help in filling in spots, but it won't help give us the shape.
intelligence is the kind of thing that's going to be able to figure this stuff out down to the smallest little vein. But intelligence won't necessarily give us the shape. It's integrity that will give us the shape. You see what I'm saying?
Can you give an example?
Well, the existence of God. Paul argues in chapter 1 of Romans that we can tell, just by looking at creation, we can tell what his eternal nature, his divine attributes, and can't remember the third one. But what he's arguing there is anybody who looks at the world objectively, that is without a prejudice, without wanting to take it someplace in particular, is going to say, there is a God. And so it's, I would say there is an example of integrity then giving shape to this tree, quite apart from intelligence. I mean, exceptional intelligence. I'm just talking normal intelligence. Yes.
So we can reason with integrity and come to the conclusion that God exists, but what is the role of the Holy Spirit in knowing that God exists?
Well, I would say that the role of the Holy Spirit is providing and maintaining the integrity that allows us to reach that conclusion. But it, apart from the work of the Holy Spirit, we cannot generate that kind of integrity. We're always going to prejudice our construction of reality in another direction.
I don't know if this is a good question or not, but where does, I haven't been able to think it through well enough, where does faith fit in? Where, it seems like faith is, it's almost like you come to a point where you can reason and logic so much and then you have to have faith. Or maybe that's not right, but I just wanted to get your opinion on how that fits in with what you're talking about. And it's okay if that's a bad question, you can tell me.
And you can tell me it's a bad answer. Faith is not... What I would argue is faith is not substantially or essentially different from knowledge. That we believe things for which there is basis to believe them. But we're believing, but those are high order things that we are believing. They are things unseen, but they are not things without evidence. That I have faith in God, not because there's no basis for it. I have faith in God because there is very good basis for it, but he is unseen. And we call that faith. So I would say it's not essentially different.
Just something that came to my mind when she was talking about how it becomes unclear at a certain point. I think that God has made it very clear. And I think that Satan has tried to make it unclear. What are your opinions on that?
Yes. That is another way of putting it. It is essentially the evil in us that has made it unclear. That there are, it is our rebelliousness against the truth that refuses to recognize that which is true.
I was thinking about Genesis 3:23, where it talks about God describes what Adam and Eve did, or what happened is that they became like us, knowing good and evil. Essentially, they're putting themselves in God's place to decide which right and which wrong for themselves. So they're, I mean, that's where we start as fallen human beings.
And that prejudices then the tree that we construct.
Prejudices how we look, how we see the colors, coverings.
So how does this rebelliousness, how does it relate to man as rational being?
Well, how would I answer that?
Can you repeat the question?
Yes, the question was, how does this rebelliousness relate to us being a rational being? How do those fit together? What I would say is we are not as rebels against God. That doesn't mean that we are less rational. It's just that it steers our reason. That our rebelliousness then keeps us from looking at the issues that need to be answered with integrity. We're always stacking the deck in favor of one answer as opposed to an answer that would lead to conclusions that are disturbing to us.
So you're saying if there's no integrity, then with our rationality?
Yeah, it does not affect the reason itself. Mm-hmm. It just affects our integrity, the way we use the reason.
Mm-hmm. What would you think of this proposition? Man cannot be defined as a rational being because his rationality is always used to rationalize, as you say, to take it where we presuppose it, where we want it to go. Mm-hmm. If we use rationality, we are not what we use. We use tools. We are the one that uses the tools. Therefore, there is a deeper reality which we are, and it is not rationality.
But there's a deeper reality that we are, and
that
is not
rationality. The deeper us uses rationality as a tool. Therefore, we cannot be defined as a rational being. We can be defined as having rationality, mm-hmm. which we use. But to say that we are a rational being is untrue because we use rationality. We use tools. We are not the tools that we use.
I don't know. I'd have to think about that and the implications of that.
I'm a weird person. I understand.
I don't know. I'd have to think about the implications of that.
Really, just so I thought I'd throw it out. Yeah.
Going back to the issue of faith, I was thinking about Thomas. It seems like when he wanted to, put his finger in Christ's side, it seems like Christ criticized him for seeking evidence. So you're saying that faith is something that is equated with knowledge. But it seems like he was saying, blessed are those who believe even though they haven't seen. It seems like in that case it was blessed are those who believe even though they haven't seen evidence. So it's like he's saying faith is something that you need to have without seeing, without having evidence.
But couldn't you understand that differently? And that would be, you are here and have the opportunity to actually experience that. Is it not truly more amazing that there are people who would come to believe without having, they trust your word that this, but they didn't actually get to feel it themselves. I don't know that's necessarily criticizing Thomas for seeking evidence.
Just lifting up even more the people that believe that have had evidence.
That
even more, he wasn't necessarily in the state of criticizing.
Right.
Thomas, he was just saying, that's fine, Thomas, it's better.
Not necessarily as better, it's more of a miracle. That I suppose, that God is working in their hearts to, let's see, how would I put that?
Doesn't it seem to say that there are different ways of knowing?
What do you mean by that?
The different ways of knowing. I mean, what? People can use different tools. I mean, there's emotional knowing, there's cognitive knowing, there's knowing through empirical testing.
There are various devices that we can use to come to know. I would say that that's true. That touching and feeling, empiricism is plays a role in it. It contributes to what we know. our emotions can do things like jog our thinking and present us with a possibility we haven't considered before. But ultimately, it all would stand before the court of reason to see whether it makes the most sense. There are various things that can present possibilities to us as to how we put together this tree. But ultimately, it's the one that's the most rational, the one that fits everything together the best, that is true. So different ways of knowing, there are different ways that we can be presented with possibilities to explore, but the only way that we can know is that one which best fits all of the others, the one that is the most rational.
So, to summarize, the question is it possible to know truth? The answer is yes, because God made it that way.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible to know truth? I would summarize it by saying yes. We all know things, and if we're honest with ourselves, we know that we know things. So things are knowable. How do we account for the fact that things are knowable? Well, the biblical worldview makes good sense, makes good accounting for how things are knowable. Why are things knowable? Because God made the cosmos to be known, and He made us to be knowers. And if there is a creator who made the world to be known and made us to be knowers, it makes sense that we would know things.
Going back to Thomas, I gathered from Thomas that it was God whom he mistrusted but himself. And I know you addressed faith already, and faith being not essentially different from the things that are knowable. But what do you do with that? It's not so much the things that are knowable that I would distrust, but, and I guess, is it that I trust the Holy Spirit with my integrity to discern those things? I mean, what do you do with that level of distrust and knowing that I am not going to be inerrant in my seeking of what's true?
Right. Ultimately, we are at God's mercy for God to make clear to us what is true. And that's the case in this entire process that we are in. We are at God's mercy. If we are to know what is true, we need Him to be at work in our lives to help us to learn what is true. So, Thomas asking for more evidence, he wants to know. And presumably God is going to respond to that want to know. I mean, if that want to know is a genuine want to know, as opposed to, I need more evidence, I don't want to believe it, so I'm going to raise the standard of what I need to have in order to be convinced of it so high that it can never be met. That is a different kind of wanting to know, demanding evidence. But if there is a sincere, heartfelt desire to know, presumably God will respond and respond in His own time and His own way. We are dependent on Him to lead us to the knowledge of the truth.
Presumably He's given you a desire to want to know.
Right. Did I answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
Did Jesus say, when the Spirit comes, He will teach you and guide you into all truth?
Mm-hmm. And I think what he's not talking about the whole tree.
Right.
He's talking about those core issues on which everything else hinges. Yes.
I think the evidence for Thomas having that right desire to know is that Jesus invited him to put his
Yeah, that is. It is interesting. Instead of saying, stay away,
right.
Don't touch
it. Or you should believe in the best.
Right. Yes?
If I believe in God and that is my tree, is there any room for randomness or unreasonable acts in the tree?
Unreasonable acts? What do you
mean? War. Murder.
There should be, because war and murder happen. I mean, if if this tree is an accurate depiction of reality, it has to include those kinds of things. And that means that whatever we believe about God has to account for the existence of those things too, because they are real. They happen. Did I answer your question or miss it?
It seems like the question comes down to how do we understand failure of, if we're reasonable people, if all people are reasonable, how do we understand when reason breaks down? And I think of it as like a 10-step algorithm that I'm trying to work out. If I make a mistake at the first step, I may come to a wrong conclusion, but I'm still employing reason to get there. I'm still a reasonable person, and a reasonable person could come to the conclusion that murder is appropriate. I think that the terrorists who launched this attack on the United States back on the 11th are reasonable people. I don't think they're insane. And it's just that in the multi-step algorithm of coming to the conclusion that that is appropriate and just thing to do, they made some serious errors. They're still employing the same tools that I do.
Right.
Hopefully, I'm guided by God's Spirit, but the fact that that our reason fails us does not mean that we are unreasonable as a creature.
Right.
Sometimes we're willing to follow a lie even though we don't believe the lie. Is that just sin? Is that just our willingness to set aside our what we know to be true?
Yeah, I would assume so. But I have to think about what happens there, because that would be rare that we would say, this is a lie, but I'm going to believe it anyway. I mean, is that...
Or follow it.
Well, but that, it seems to me that that would be really rare, because I mean, you work with criminals. How many criminals say, don't have any justification for what they did? I mean, don't most of them come up with some kind of justification? They may admit what I did was wrong, and it may be illegal, but there's some reason I justified it. My father beat me. Right. My father beat me. I don't have enough money or something. We really want to rationalize. We really want to come up with some line of justification for everything that we do. Can we do something that is a lie and have no justification for it at all? I think that'd be tough. I mean, I think that there would be a justification for even doing something that is a lie. I mean, that sounds like a theme for Dostoevsky to work out in one of his novels. But I would think that there would be some rationalization somewhere for even that.
Would that be described as self-deception?
Well, yeah.
Okay. So, do you think there is such a thing as sincere disbelief?
Well, it depends on what you mean by sincere.
Well, if rationality, although maybe not perfect, is sufficient to know the truth, and if the Spirit of God is calling possibly everybody, I don't think that, will there ever be anyone who can claim, I didn't know? Will anyone ever stand before God in complete innocence and say, I didn't know? Or does it take that momentary rational choice to suppress that knowledge in order to continue in disbelief?
Well, I think at its deepest level, there has to be the suppression. Now, if you were to ask someone, are you a sincere unbeliever? I think you'd get people to say yes. And their plan before God after they die is to make that argument. But ultimately it won't fly. The suppression is the only the only thing that can happen.
Yeah. Isn't that the purpose of the law? I could suppress everything I want, but if I kill you, if I steal from you, if I lie about you to harm you, then I know that, I know on that bottom level, I know that I'm violating something on the top. And nobody could live very long without a conscious, even if it's unconscious to them, suppression. It's impossible.
Okay, one more. Did you have a question?
Yeah. In Genesis, God asked Adam not to eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And so I wonder if why and how much does that request apply to mankind now that the apple has been ate from back then.
And what are you thinking that the commandment meant?
That everything was fine in the garden, and I'm not really sure because I don't even know why the tree was there in the first place. But I'm just wondering, like, should I just find certain things to be content with and not be a seeker and just have a simple, content life with God? Or should I truly be a seeker so much that it just overwhelms me and confuses me and I see no light?
Can I have a third choice? It's significant that that was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, not just knowledge in general. And there, I think, the issue was, by putting that tree in the garden, it gave Adam and Eve a choice to be made. By putting that tree in the garden and telling them, do not eat from it, now there's a choice to be made. Am I going to eat from it, or am I not? So they have to choose between obedience and disobedience. So the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is a device that was used by God to present Adam and Eve with the decision, am I going to choose good or am I going to choose evil? Am I going to come to know experientially evil? But as to whether we should pursue knowledge in general, God made us to be knowers. And I think that what comes along with that is a desire to know, a curiosity. It may be that understanding all of reality is too formidable. There's too much out there and it's too confusing. But that doesn't mean that I ought to stop seeking truth. There is a certain segment of truth that is more important than other parts of truth. And that is this area up here. With respect to this, who is God, who am I, and the relationship between us, our curiosity should be constantly operative. That is, how do I figure this out? What does it mean to be a human being when there is a God who is of the nature that the Bible describes him to be? And we're not talking about doing research. What we're talking about is living life, and living life in a way that we take seriously the choices and the decisions that we make. That is, we're living life, we're working this through. What does God require of me here? How ought I to respond to this? Why did this sort of thing happen? What does that say about God? Etc., etc., etc. So there's a sense in which what we're all called to be is specialists, and specialize in a certain kind of knowledge, and that is this stuff. Who is God, and what does it mean to be one of his creatures? Okay, last question.
My question is, could not a Muslim cleric have given the exact same talk you have and switched books?
To the extent that I have laid it out here, I think so. I don't know if you would, but I think so.
So now which truth is right?
Well, now it has to be filled in. What kind of God is this? This stuff has to be filled out. I haven't filled out any of this. I mean, the Muslim view of the world, I think, would have the same view of, is truth knowable? Right? I mean, I don't know that much about Islam, but I would assume that they would give the same response.
And so then what's the distinction comes in, and they're going to say, yes, it's possible to know truth, and this is the steps we take to know truth, just like you have there, and they're going to say, this is good. You know, I mean, they're going to, whatever you fill in there, they're going to fill in something different, and they're,
right. Their view of God is going to be very, very different.
But it's, I mean.
So the question is, which one matches reality? And what I would argue is, one of our key sources for information with respect to the nature of God is from Scripture. They're going to argue it's from the Quran. Well, let's see. Let's set them down next to each other. You give me the reason that you think the Quran is inspired, and I'll give you the reason why I think that the Bible is reliable, is inspired and reliable. And let's see. Show us the evidence. Which is more reasonable?
Can we do that next week?
That's 2 weeks from now. Okay, thank you.